Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is James H. McCommons, Professor Emeritus at Northern Michigan University, and a veteran journalist specializing in ecology, environmental, and travel topics. And we're talking about his new book, The Feather Wars and the Great Crusade to Save America's Birds. James, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thank you.
This history covers so much territory. What brought you to write the story of the rise of bird conservation?
Well, the book I wrote previously of this was called Camera Hunter. It was the biography of George Shiras III. And George Shiras III appears in this book. He was a wildlife photographer around the turn of the century, and the one who first introduced the concept of the Migratory Bird Act. And so when I wrote that book, I just learned about a lot of the history around the turn of the century, how low in numbers many animals were at that time, particularly birds, and also had to learn who all these people were that were interacting with George in Congress at that time. And it made me realize that there was a bigger story to tell. And that's kind of where it came from.
It's an amazing story. I don't think most people have ever heard about the early days of market gunning. But I want to start with the beginning of the book. The introduction begins in Cloverland in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And people are going to find this hard to believe, but at one point, Canada geese were almost extinct.
Yes. It's a fact that amazes a lot of people. It amazed me the first time that I actually heard about that, and that was several years ago. But yes, that they were one of the critters that were at a low ebb during that period.
And it's also about the creation of the Seney National Wildlife Refuge, which is the other half of your story.
That's right. And the creation of the wildlife refuges come later in the book, but it was a way to tie them all together. Plus, Seney is not very far from where I live, and I spent a lot of time there. So that's where I kind of started the book to, you know, kind of give an outline of what was to come in the rest of the chapters.
The pursuit of birds in the first chapters of this book are unbelievably brutal. I mean, the slaughter of birds, the culling of their eggs, the killing of birds for their feathers in the late 18th century, in the early 19th century, the scope of it, which you cover brilliantly, is so extensive. The statistics are crazy. Did you know that occurred before?
Yes, but I didn't know all of the ways that it happened. I was surprised, for instance, about the amount of birds that were used in the pet trade.
Yep.
And also, I didn't know much about oology, which was the collection of wild bird eggs. And that for people, you know, people ate wild bird eggs back then, but there was this whole group of collectors who were sort of in a kind of mania about the fact that they wanted to collect all the bird eggs of the birds in their county or in their state. And of course, taking bird eggs from people, people taking bird eggs from birds, obviously is going to hurt the population.
It's an unbelievable slaughter. There was no idea of a daily bag limit or hunting seasons. And these people, especially for hunting for the market, would go out with essentially cannons and just shoot into these flocks of birds by the thousands.
Yes, yes. I mean, the idea was simply to harvest the resource that was out there, and there were a lot of birds out there, and the idea of sportsmanship or bag limits, those kind of things, they simply didn't exist. They did this because there were no laws to stop them. And there was a great demand from people to have these animals available for consumption in restaurants or in homes.
Yeah, people don't realize that people ate shorebirds. People ate a lot of different species of birds than they do today.
They absolutely did. And that was true of the sport hunters that emerged around the 1880s, that their idea of a game bird was not what we would consider today. They shot a lot of different kinds of birds and consumed a lot of different kinds of birds that we would not do today.
You, in the book, you sort of subtly see this as part and parcel of the time period, the Gilded Age, of unchecked capitalism and greed at the time, that people just thought it was okay to take it all.
They did. And and that really extends to a lot of types of natural resources. There was this idea of a limitlessness to the American continent. We can cut down as many trees as we want.
Right.
We can drain as much land as we want. We can shoot birds. We can shoot lots of passenger pigeons, although they'll be back next year with lots more. The same thing was true with the bison on the Great Plains. It was sort of this unconstrained frenzy of growth and not thinking that there were limits, and mentally really thinking that there was always going to be more. It wasn't that they were deluding themselves. It was a strong feeling that that was true.
I mean, there were things, and I've read books about market gunning before, but there are things called side hunts.
Yes.
I had never heard of that before. Basically, people just killed everything in an area and then tallied it up at the end of the day.
That's right. And it was a Christmas tradition.
Jesus.
When people got together after the harvest was in, and they would choose sides and go out and shoot literally every kind of wildlife that they saw during that day.
And there was a point
bring
system.
Them back, yeah, bring them back, score them, and the losing side would either have to make a feast for the other side, or the losing side sometimes was made to eat crow, literally eat crow. It was amazing what they'd shoot. They would shoot muskrats, cats, feral cats, any kind of animal that was loose, and each one was assigned a point.
It's amazing. You have a whole chapter about there was one lake that had the nation's highest, densest population of canvasbacks, which were a much prized duck at the time. And how people just wiped out all that population.
Right, right. That was Lake Surprise down in Texas near Galveston Bay. There were a lot of canvasbacks in the north, particularly in the Chesapeake Bay region. But in Texas, these three lakes, particularly Lake Surprise, were a hotbed of canvasback because of the kind of grasses that were there. And yeah, a fairly wealthy man from Galveston Island made a business out of it. And so I told the story of two young hunters who went to work for him on that island.
Jeez. There's a quote from your book, 40 ducks were considered a good day's shooting. And in a typical season, club members, and there were clubs to do this, 30,000 birds would be shot in a season. In 1883, a shooter brought down 300 birds in a day. Obviously, that was unsustainable, but didn't people see the numbers of waterfowl declining?
They eventually did. Absolutely. I mean, you can't have that kind of carnage that you would not have, that it wouldn't become evident at some point. But again, there was a mentality among sport hunting, and sport hunting sort of emerged around that time in the 1880s, and this is separate from the actual market hunters, that a good day was to kill a lot of birds, and bag limits really didn't come into the equation. And so, yeah, they would shoot 300 birds. They'd often leave them on the water. Sometimes they'd pick them up and they could take them into town where they could sell them because the butchers and other middlemen were quite willing to purchase them because there was a market for them. But for the sport hunting, initially, it was to go out and shoot birds. on the Virginia coast, they would go out and shoot wading birds, you know, oyster catchers and other birds that are on the shore, and didn't eat many of them, but just killed them because they killed them for fun.
What's amazing is you also trace the state of ornithology at that time too, and even ornithologists shot large numbers of birds. People like William Brewster and Elliot Cowes, they would recommend that if you saw a new species, shoot 50 or 100 of every species that you saw. Why?
Try to get them in their different life stages also, so you could trade them to other people when you were exchanging your bird skins. You know, the initial, what they call shotgun ornithology or scientific ornithology, was optics weren't very good. Certainly they could recognize birds that they were seeing, some of the more common birds, but birds are kind of fleet. They're hard to see. Didn't have great optics, so the way you found out what kind of bird you were looking at, you shot it and brought it down. If you brought down eventually those many specimens, that would give you an opportunity to study those, you know, in a museum or in your home, and clearly look at classifying those birds. So part of it was that it was an age of classification when they wanted to measure every part of the bird, the feathers, and that this was the way to do it, was to have a bird in hand versus, you know, a bird up in the air.
It was also, as you write, the era of great private collections of skins of birds. And most of those would later be donated to museums.
They are. And even today, you can't sell these kinds of collections, these private collections. Once they leave private hands, they have to be sold or given to a museum. So I went to a museum in California. I can't remember the name of it right now, but it's one of the largest ones for birds and eggs. And it is the culmination of dozens and dozens and dozens of private collections.
Now, your book really traces several threads, a number of threads, that ended up changing the public's idea about how we thought about birds. Sometimes it was legislation, like one of the key pieces of legislation was the 1918 Migratory Bird Treaty Act. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, that act was really the culmination of a lot of effort before that. 1900, there was the Lacey Act, and that was where the federal government really first stepped in to start protecting birds on a national level. Otherwise, much of the protection, if there was any at all, was done at the state level, and those state laws were varied in great degree. But the idea was that a lot of these birds that were being killed for the market were crossing state lines, and there needed to be some sort of federal regulation about what was going on, right? That if a bird was poached in Nebraska, shot out of season, because there were seasons starting to happen, if that bird was smuggled across the border, then it could be sold in another state. And there would be no penalty for that. So there was that that was introduced. George Shiras in 1904 introduced the first, what became the Migratory Bird Act, when he introduced a bill that he knew was not going to pass at that time, which was called the Shiras Bird Bill. And that was just to protect game birds. George was a hunter. He was more interested in game birds. That didn't pass because there was still a lot of opposition from the South and from these states that were making money on market hunting. However, by 1913, a lot of this had kind of changed. A lot of this opposition had changed because there were so fewer birds out there that it was evident something needed to be done. So the Migratory Bird Act was passed in 1913. Which then began to give control and jurisdiction of all birds to the federal government to set, you know, set seasons, set bag limits, and that those laws would supersede state laws. And very quickly, some of these states, particularly in the Gulf Coast and along the Mississippi River, where there was a lot of market hunting going on, fought back. There was a U.S. Supreme Court case at that time. The U.S. Supreme Court heard the case but didn't make a decision, partly because they realized that the federal government under the Woodrow Wilson administration was trying to get a treaty with Canada, because birds cross state boundaries, but they also cross international boundaries. And that eventually passed. We signed a treaty with Canada. Then there was another shooting in Missouri, where that went up to the Supreme Court. And at that point, the Supreme Court ruled no, because of the U.S. Supremacy Clause of the U.S. Constitution, the treaty is the law of the land. And that put an end to the whole idea that states could set their own laws and the feds had nothing to do with it. So it's sort of a culmination between 1900 and 1919 of the feds taking more and more jurisdiction control of birds, and then treating them as a national trust. These birds belong to all Americans, even if they're flying between different states, even different countries, and we need to protect them.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is James H. McCommons, professor emeritus at Northern Michigan University and a veteran journalist specializing in ecology, environmental, and travel topics. And we're talking about his book. It's a monumental history, The Feather Wars and the Great Crusade to Save America's Birds. There were organizations that started to pop up. One of the ones that I really loved reading the history of, because I know people who are still in it, the Nuttall Ornithological Club. Can you talk about how that started?
Sure. I mean, the George Bird Grinnell was a young man from New York City. He was raised in the northern part of Manhattan and became friends with the Audubon family. Now, John James Audubon at that time was had been deceased, but George went to school with the Audubon children. He became fascinated by all of these things, birds. And then later he had an interesting career for about 10 years where he was going out west. He was hunting for fossils. He was on an expedition with George Custer before Custer was killed. And he did work in Yellowstone. So when he was back in New York, he started to write for a magazine called Forest and Stream. And Forest and Stream was one of the first sporting journals of that period, catering to sportsmen who were just sort of emerging around the 1880s as sport hunting as a leisurely pursuit, typically among gentlemen. And George Grinnell eventually took over Forest and Stream magazine, and he made it the most important sporting journal of the period. Everybody read it. Hunters read it. Politicians read it. Biologists, naturalists read it. And within the that magazine, he started to write stories about the slaughter of birds, particularly about women wearing bird feathers and birds on their hats, which was killing a lot of birds to supply the industry. He started about 1887, he started the Audubon Society. And so that was the first version of the Audubon Society. And he asked people to send in a postcard and say that that I pledge not to kill birds. And then later he started a magazine to teach these people how to watch birds. So there was sort of an emergence now of a bird watching community. Now that magazine only lasted for 2 years, and then he found that he was overwhelmed with all the people who wanted to join it, and the magazine wasn't making enough money to support the printing costs and those kinds of things. So he let it go, and but thinking that somebody else may pick it up, and somebody else did pick it up about 3 years later, and that was the two women from Boston, who are sort of famous as the mothers of the modern Audubon Society.
Now, there's so many people mentioned in your book.
One of them, a lot.
Yeah, but there's one of them I'm really glad because I've been, I have an original copy of Birds Through an Opera Glass. Florence Merriam from Smith College, she wrote this book, and it's amazing reading it. It's like the first field guide to American birds.
It is. Florence Merriam did some amazing work. She was born in 1863. She was in this interesting family where her father was a banker and a congressman, but her father was fascinated with glaciation. And her mother went to Rutgers, and her mother practiced astronomy. An aunt down the road practiced botany. And her brother, C. Hart Merriam, who later became the head of the U.S. Biological Survey, the forerunner of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, she was very close to her brother, Hart. And Hart was a shotgun scientific ornithologist. I think he actually studied medicine, but he was shooting birds at a very young age. His father actually built a museum on the property. They lived in a beautiful home just south of the Adirondack Mountains. Florence went off to Smith College, and there she got interested in birds. And, well, she was interested before him. But she got interested when George Grinnell started his Audubon Society. So she started one at Smith and was trying to convince her fellow classmates that they should not be wearing birding hats or hats made out of bird feathers. And she also started to take them on bird watching trips as well. And then in her senior year, she started to write articles for George Bird Grinnell and his, you know, short-lived Audubon magazine, and eventually turned those articles into this book that was all about birds through the opera glass. And what she was saying was that we can enjoy birds without shooting them. We can use our observational skills to watch their behaviors. You can learn how to identify birds without shooting them, and you can do this with the use of opera glasses, which were very primitive at that time, binoculars, maybe 3x power.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's the first field guide. It's the first one where she really talks about optics, and she targeted that book to young people and to women and the people who were looking to enjoy birds for the aesthetic of birds. And many of these people became known as the bird sentimentalists.
Because they weren't the bird ornithologists. They weren't the serious.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
She recommended, that's what right. I loved is, I love the, first of all, the book does fit in your pocket. It's a small book. She recommends that you sort of take the opera glasses, a notebook, and a chair, and just sort of park yourself somewhere in the edge of the woods or a field and just sit there for a while and observe.
Right.
It was a whole different approach to looking at nature.
It was. It was a more holistic kind of approach. It was to view these birds in their environment outdoors and note their behaviors rather than shooting the bird, bringing it in, to a lab or your house, dissecting it, and experience the bird that way. That's all good for text, you know, for classification, but her thing was it was about bird behavior.
Right, exactly. Now, we're
she wrote
Go ahead. No, go you go
well,
ahead.
Well, she wrote the book in a kind of chatty voice.
Yeah.
And something that would be accessible to her readers, that she wanted to write something that wasn't for the ornithologist. It was more for the person who simply wanted to love birds. And that's one of the reasons why it is called, you know, one of the first field guides.
Of all the, we only have 2 minutes left. Of all the people that you wrote about, was there a favorite? Was there a person you really like was fascinating? You would write, you would think about writing a full book about that person?
That's interesting.
Because I'll tell you, the story about the McElhinney, the Tabasco sauce magnet.
Yes.
What a wild character.
Absolutely. So E.H. McElhinney was part of the family that created the hot sauce.
Yep. But we're completely, that's my vote for writing a whole book about somebody.
Yeah.
But there's so many stories in this book. It's an absolutely amazing history. My guest tonight has been James H. McCommons, Professor Emeritus at Northern Michigan University, veteran journalist specializing in ecology, environmental, and travel topics. And we've been talking about his new book. We could talk about it for days. The Feather Wars and the Great Crusade to Save America's Birds. Whew. James, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.